welcome to another episode of the Enthusiasticast, the web show where we always recommend an awesome book. He's Mark, I'm John, and this week I'll be talking about Joshua Foer's memory memoir, Moonwalking with Einstein. But before that, Mark, I want to talk about two other books I read, one which pinwheeled out of last episode's discussion of Richard Morgan's The Steel Remains, and one based on your very own recommendation, Ian Tregillis's Bitter Seeds. So you recommended Tregillis back in episode 51, and I'm sure it comes as no surprise to you that when I finally got around to it in the stack, I absolutely loved it. So for listeners who haven't heard that episode, do you think you can recap the high points of the setup for the book?
So do you want me to tee up the review, or do you want me to tee up the plot of the book?
Just the plot of the book, like what's it about?
Okay, so So alternate history of World War II, there's like the Axis versus the Allies, standard thing, right? So the Nazis have spawned kind of a set of like Nietzschean super soldiers, and they're just really orphans with superpowers, right? And then the British, all perfect, gentlemanly, you know, British chaps, you know, the whole amateur spirit and all that. Well, they have a super secret anti-weapon that is actually, I guess it's sorcery, really. Magic powers of their own, which they tap into much in the way that they really did with Enigma, right? So they go into the secret stuff. So the book is about epic forces battling each other in both like the macro and micro senses, and it's I found it to be a real feast. And I don't know, what did you think?
I loved it. I thought it was absolutely fantastic. I mean, obviously, just based on your recommendation, you know, I was pretty much down for the cause. But then I just found there was just so much richness in it when I read it. You mentioned briefly in the episode that a lot of what it concerned was, you know, that once a weapon is developed, it will be used. And I thought that was really interesting. And, you know, when I was reading it, I have, you know, this big VMI bonnet lately about, you know, having characters who are sympathetic but not necessarily likable, and about really tightening the screws on characters in terms of the drama. And I really thought that this did that, right? I mean, Tregillis is merciless with his characters. He absolutely tortures them. And at the same time, you have that thing, you know, sort of based around once you've made the decision to go to war, to be at war, to participate in a war, you've made the decision that people are going to die. And once you've put that into the, you know, realm of the acceptable, how far do you go with that? And I thought it was just like a great war story. And all the genre trappings were just totally in service to that. I thought it was a really good marriage of, you know, just having the genre trappings actually add something to sort of the themes of the book rather than taking away from it or being besides the point.
There's a lot of like moral ambivalence in there, right?
And tons.
Yeah. So that works against the book in some ways, because you're just like, oh, I don't know if I should be, I don't know how I should feel about this point of view character, right? But he, in my mind anyway, compensates for that by having this kind of relentless plotting. So even if you, like, as you drive by a character and you stop and capture a moment with them, and either it's, you know, either it's too wooden or it's too, like, it's either really provocative or it's not, that's only momentary until you're propelled along onto the next plot development anyway.
Yeah, no, it really reads along at a good clip. Although, as you noted the first time that you recommended it, it is part one of a trilogy, but it's a satisfying reading experience on its own. And the good news is that there have been delays. I don't know exactly what the source is of the delays with the trilogy, but the mass market of the first book, Bitter Seeds, is coming in May, June 2012. And then the next month, it's supposed to see the hardcover and ebook release of The Coldest War, which is part two. And then about a year later, in April 2013, the final part necessary evil is supposedly coming, although, you know, getting that far out, dates tend to slip. The one thing that is interesting to me, which is exciting, is that an audio version of the second book is going to be out on December 20th, 2010. So like 5-6 months in advance of the print release, there's going to be an audio release, which actually, interestingly, happened with the second book in the Millennium Trilogy. The audio for that came out far in advance of the North American paper and ebook release.
Right, because the publisher, realizing what they've got in their hands, puts the brakes on all this stuff, right? And it's what happened with Daniel Suarez as well.
Right. They were obviously, you know, sort of marshaling their forces to do, a much bigger and more concerted blitz with these books.
But of course, then the audio publisher who bought the rights at the same time is just like, no, I'm keeping my schedule, man. That's awesome. Okay. I didn't know that.
So that's a win for us. So, I just wanted to add my voice to your voice in recommending that book.
What I was really, don't want to take too long talking about this, but the superpower nature of the thing, like, did you feel that it was a direct ripoff of kind of X-Men? Because
no.
I thought that would totally play into your wheelhouse and you would be stoked about it. But then I was just like, I don't know if it really came alive in the way that I sold it to you as.
It didn't. It didn't. What it really reminded me of is the Wild Card series. And I've read these ages ago and they're still being published now. And if you're not familiar with the Wild Cards books, they're edited by George R.R. Martin, who does Song of Ice and Fire. And there's a bunch of different authors contributing narratives. So they're like group written novels, and each author will take a different set of characters or a different plot thread and write them. And they're set in a universe, fictional universe, where people have superpowers because of this alien virus. And they're done in a very, you know, they came out of the sort of the 80s movement of deconstructionist superheroes, of very realistically drawn superheroes in the superhero genre. The sort of at the pinnacle of that would be Watchmen by Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons. And so this very much reminded me of Wild Cards in the way that it handled the superpowers, the supernatural powers. And then it turns out that Tregillis cut his teeth as a writer in the Wild Card series and is still writing for that series.
Oh, okay. No way.
Yeah. So, that's all good stuff. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. So that element really, really worked for me. What the supernatural elements on the British sides of things sort of harken back to, I mean, there's just generally a way that British writers handle mysticism, which is different than the way I would say American writers handle mysticism, that I've always particularly enjoyed. So that was an unexpected pleasure in the book, and I'm really interested to see the way that plays out in the long term, because it does seem to take the notion of the superpower and then crank it up by like a factor of 10.
Cool. Okay, so what's book two? Like, so we talked about Morgan Still Remains, and what spawned out of that?
Well, it's funny, this all seems to come out of that one episode. So in that episode, you recommended, you were enthusiastic about Bitter Seeds, which I've now finally read and loved. And in the walk up to that episode, we talked about books that were coming out in spring 2011 that we were excited about. One of which was Moonwalking with Einstein. That was a book that you were excited about, and that was the first time I'd heard about it. And now I'm going to be recommending it at the back of the show. And then in the comments for that episode, that was when Tom recommended The Still Remains by Richard Morgan. And getting ready for the last episode where you were going to talk about that book, I went back and I looked at that recommendation, and my response to it at the time was that that was a great recommendation because one of the things that I'd been looking to sample to sort of broaden my reading was gay-themed fiction or, you know, fiction by gay authors. And I was either going to read The Still Remains or I was going to read a book called Hero by Perry Moore. And when I went back and I saw that comment, I was like, oh yeah, where were my good intentions? Where was, you know, this desire to broaden my horizons? And of course you'd already read The Still Remains. So I went and I picked up Hero by Perry Moore. And so the deal with this book is, it's right in my wheelhouse. It's funny. I was thinking about this in terms of because the Moonwalking with Einstein book is a sort of science biography, science narrative, in the same way that, you know, Malcolm Gladwell kind of writes. I was thinking about a Gladwell essay where he talks about ketchup. Have you ever read this?
No, but I've talked to you about it so many times that your retelling of it is more prominent in my memory than whether or not I actually read it myself.
Well, this is why I love Gladwell, because he's great for the metaphors, right? He's great for the things that you can just sort of take out of context and then apply in your everyday life.
And so was this a New Yorker essay?
I think it was a New Yorker essay. I read it in What the Dog Saw, which was a collection of all of those sort of extraneous essays, right, that didn't have a home. And so this was the essay that he wrote about ketchup and why the appeal of ketchup and why have there, you know, in mustard, there are many different mustards, and yet in ketchup, there's only Heinz. So, you know, what's up with that? And he looks at ketchup, and as sort of a digression from that, he talks about the fact that, you know, ketchup is like the perfect four-quadrant food. It, you know, it tastes good in all the different ways that taste is measured. And he makes some sort of weird little connection between the fact that from an evolutionary perspective, we would have been rewarded for eating the same foods over and over again. So we're kind of, because if you vary and you just sort of go out and pick things up, if you're like a hunter-gatherer, you might pick up something that's poison and die, right? So we're sort of programmed on that level to eat things that are familiar. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But then he posited ketchup as the ultimate familiarizer, right? Which is why kids will eat anything so long as it's with ketchup. You know, it's like, here's sushi and ketchup. You know, so I was thinking about that in terms of picking up this book, Hero, by Perry Moore, because for me, in a literary sense, superheroes are my literary ketchup. This is like, you take anything, you know, whatever it is, whatever genre, whatever point of view, whatever subject matter, and you just, you know, liberally put some superheroes on there, fine, I'll try that. And that's pretty much what Hero by Perry Moore is. It's a young adult novel about a young superhero coming of age. He has, you know, a whole backstory with his father, who was at one point, you know, one of the most prominent heroes in the world, but now lives in disgrace for some unnamed tragedy that he was involved in that, you know, is kept in the dark for a significant portion of the book. And he begins to develop powers and has to, in secret, go and become a superhero and sort of join up with the sort of premier super team of the world. And this all is mirroring the fact that he is also a closeted gay teen, and he can't tell his father that he's gay, and he can't tell anybody that he's gay, or he doesn't feel like he can tell anybody that he's gay. And so the two sort of plots, you know, mirror one another as he comes to terms with his secret identity and his secret life as a superhero. He's also coming to terms with being gay and how that's going to work in his family life and his social life and his professional life. And so honestly, after reading it, for me, in terms of why I was reading it, almost too much ketchup. It was just like, I was like, oh wow, that was a really great superhero story. And yet that wasn't really what I was interested in reading in that moment. I really, like, going way back to the beginning of the show, I sort of, you know, totted up what I was reading. In my mind, I had always thought, oh, I'm a diverse reader. I read a lot of different things. So, and then I, you know, I looked at what I was actually reading and who was writing what I was actually reading. And I was like, oh, so, you know, I read a diverse amount, so long as your definition of diverse is literary fiction or one or two genres of fiction, all of which is written by heterosexual white men who, you know, come from English-speaking countries, which that's not really diversity. And that's when I started to, you know, I read some books in the romance genre. I really tried to read a lot of books by female authors. And so I, you know, going beyond that, I was like, I don't think I've ever, you know, maybe 20 years ago, I read some Timothy Finley. Beyond that, have I read any books by gay authors? I didn't think that I had. So this was one that I knew about, and I wanted to pick it up just on that. And like I said, I enjoyed it. It was a fun superhero story, and there were parts of it that were that were really compelling. You know, reading it, I found the relationship between the father and the son to be really interesting. And that's the spine of the book. And then, of course, afterwards, reading about it, Perry Moore in interviews said that the father character was basically his father, who was a Vietnam veteran and had won the Bronze Star. And, you know, those two relationships mapped pretty closely to one another. So, you know, that was great. And I almost wish that I had had that story divorced from all of the superhero trappings. Whereas in Bitter Seeds, I felt like the superpowered stuff, you know, really added to it and deepened it. I felt like, and I could see what Perry Moore was doing. I honestly think he was like, he was putting the ketchup on there because he wants the teenage audience, the teenage boys particularly, to pick this up and read this. And, you know, you add in like, you know, crazy superhero fights, it makes it go down a lot easier. And so I definitely think that was a smart call on his part. But at the end of the day, I was like, oh, I'd really like to read a more literary take on the same subject matter, or, you know, maybe from the same point of view. So I'm putting the call out. If there's anybody in the audience who can think of something on this topic that I would enjoy reading, please let me know. Because I've looked on the internet and it hasn't really been helpful. So,
well, okay. So, like, a gay superhero is kind of like a gay cowboy. You can play that tongue. Well, you can take that. You can write that in a number of different ways, right? So there's lots of rich material either satirize or do straight up, or you know what I mean.
And it is pretty much done straight up. And I, again, afterwards, reading the book, then reading interviews with Perry Moore, he wrote the book largely in reaction to the treatment of identified gay superheroes in mainstream comics. And I could, you know, looking back, I can absolutely see that, because it is abysmal, the history there. And so this was his attempt to write a straight up superhero story. It's bad phrasing, but to write a superhero who was a hero the same way the heterosexual heroes were that he grew up reading about, that he, you know, grew up enjoying and loving in their adventures in the comics. Right. And also sort of marry that to a tale of, you know, of coming out, of accepting your sexuality. And like I say, I think he succeeds on all of those fronts. Any problems I had with the book were more that once I got into it, I was like, no, this doesn't go as far as I would like it to.
Okay. So, can we just talk about Tom Hanks's career for a second?
I'm always up for talking about Tom Hanks's career.
Like, what is going on with that guy? Like, he is totally like Spielberged out. Now he's like producing films. He is releasing, or both producing and starring in, Extremely Loud, Extremely Loud and Extremely Close. What's it called?
Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close.
Right. That which is coming out, I don't know, Christmas-ish, and looks terrible. I was just like, oh God, what are you doing, man? And so I bought that book and couldn't get into it or whatever, so I got like a chapter in and put it down. But that trailer is not doing that book any favors at all. Now, of course, his brother, his younger brother, I guess, is
Jonathan Safran Foer's younger brother.
Is a
not Tom Hanks's younger brother.
That's true.
I believe Tom Hanks's younger brother actually does the voice for all of the licensed Woody characters. So if you have a Woody doll at home and that, you know, says lines from the movie, or you have a Toy Story video game where the character of Woody speaks, that's not actually Tom Hanks. That's Tom Hanks's brother.
Oh, that's interesting. So we've talked at length about Jonathan Safran Foer back, you know, when you actually got me the Tree of Codes.
Yes.
And I've expressed my opinion about him in all kinds of ways on the show, so I won't do that again. But his younger brother is a novelist as well, and happens to also write the occasional essay. And so this is his first nonfiction book, is it not?
Yes.
Set it up.
So, did you actually go, because you were interested in reading this. This is a book that was on your radar, not mine.
I still am, actually, yeah.
And but you haven't read it?
No. Okay. It's, I'm sitting here looking at the copy of Born to Run that I have on my desk.
Well, it's funny that you should mention that, because these two books...
It's very similar, aren't they?
They are so similar.
Yep.
So similar.
So, I've read neither, and... I have every intent to read both, but...
So Born to Run was a nonfiction book that I recommended, which was all about ultramarathoning and extreme running, and it sort of did three different things in that it told a contemporary story about these, you know, runners from South America and about a race that the author organized, this ultramarathon that the author organized and trained for and ran in. And then it looked at the history of running, and then it looked at the science of running. And the book that I'm going to recommend today, Moonwalking with Einstein, by Joshua Foer, it follows that same structure. So basically what happens, and you mentioned all of this when you initially talked about the book, is that Josh Foer is a young guy, journalist, freelance, looking for ideas for stories to write, and gets interested in memory, just how your memory works, how to improve your memory, and ends up at the American Memory Championships, the U.S. Memory Championships, where he discovers that there's this whole world of competitive mental athletes, competitive memory athletes, who can memorize a deck of cards in a minute and a half, and can remember pi to like 20,000 digits, and all of this sort of thing. And he meets some real characters, writes an article, I think it ends up on Slate, and, you know, gets a big response, and so keeps following up on it. And then this, of course, leads into a book. So in the book, he talks about the science of memory, what we know about memory, how memory operates, and he goes around and he talks to, you know, various scientists, and talks to just some... looks at some really fascinating case studies from history. This guy S, he's just known as S because his full name was redacted from the literature, and he's a guy who remembers literally everything that happens to him. He forgets absolutely nothing. If you have coffee with him on a Tuesday, 10 years later, he'll be able to tell you what time it was, what day of the week it was, what the date was, where you had the coffee, what you talked about, what shirt you were wearing, everything, it's all there. And he goes to the other end of the spectrum and he talks to a guy who has no memory, like is unable to form long-term memories, and even his short-term memory is very crippled, and he will forget who you are while he's talking to you. Like he can remember something while he's concentrating on it, but if you snap your fingers, distract him, whatever, he's forgotten. He talks to a guy who is completely externalizing his memory. He works for Microsoft, and he's recording everything in his life using, you know, audio and video, and has just gigs and gigs and gigs and gigs and gigs of like the last, I can't remember how long it was, but it was something like 10, 15 years of his life, but also trying to create it in some kind of really searchable database. So he looks at the science of memory, like how do our brains work? How do our brains form memories? It's kind of a wide open field. There is not a ton that is known, especially because it's really difficult to do experiments on the human brain without being completely unethical. So you kind of have to wait for somebody with a really unique and specific brain injury to turn up so that you can then, because you can't just go around giving brain injuries to people to see what happens. So it's, you know, it's a slow process. So that's the science aspect. And then he looks at the history of memory and how the art of memory and the art of memorizing has functioned in our society from ancient times, looking at the, you know, the Homeric poems, the oral traditions, the memory palace, which is the this first notion of improving your memory, of learning tricks and techniques that will allow you to remember more accurately. And then he looks at that, how that relates to the written word. And this is the kind of conversation that comes up all the time, right? I've said this myself, that, you know, in the world of Google, knowing a lot doesn't necessarily mean a lot. What you have to know is how to find and manipulate what you find. And so he explores that, and he explores the meaning of memory in a world where there are devices that will remember for us. And then the spine of the book, all of that is married to this narrative, which is he hooks up with this guy, Ed, who is a international grandmaster of memory. He's British. And Ed says to him, you know, takes him aside after the first U.S. memory championship. They're talking. I think he's interviewing Ed for the piece. And Ed says, you know, like, I can teach you the tricks. They're not that difficult to learn. You have to practice them. But honestly, and the interesting thing that comes out is that on the world stage, the American memory champions are middle to lower tier. They don't stack up against the European and Asian memory champions for whatever reason. And so Ed tells him that, I think, honestly, with a year's work, you could do very well in the U.S. memory championships. Like, I think that you could perform, you know, at a very high level. And so there's this element. I mean, the whole notion of the memory championships and the characters that take part in them, it's reminiscent of, you know, kind of the spelling bee craze, where, although in comparison, spelling bee's way more mainstream, right? Like, if you think that, you know, spelling bees are kind of, you know, oddball as a sport, memory championships are another 3 degrees to the left of that. But nonetheless, he hooks up with Ed, and he starts on this training program, and really, really improves under Ed's tutelage using these techniques, so much so that, and it says this right in the beginning of the book, a year later, when he goes back to compete in the U.S. Memory Championship, he ends up in the finals, you know, competing with the best American mnemonists. That's what they're called, because they're using mnemonic tricks to learn, you know, how to quickly memorize a deck of cards, or they'll be shown a bunch of headshots, like 100 headshots, with a first and last name attached to each headshot, and then they have to remember as many as they can. And there's a bunch of other different competitions that go on. And it was fascinating. It was such a great read. He's got a wonderful prose style. He's very funny. But he's also, I think, a really good journalist. And we talked about Gladwell before, or I mentioned Gladwell before, and he comes under a lot of fire for, you know, scientific inaccuracies, or, you know, trying to conflate two things that don't really go together, or trying to massage things to, you know, make them add up to more than the sum of their parts. Josh Foer really goes the other way. Like, he questions himself. He questions his own motives. He questions the facts as they are presented to him, because he meets a ton of self-professed gurus and savants as he travels through this world of international mental athleticism, and he really questions what he's told. And then even when he starts to have measurable, practical results from doing these techniques, like, he can't deny that he learned to remember things, you know, at this level. Like, it's not, he did it. The proof is in the pudding. But then he questions, well, what is the use of it? You know, how does this relate to the rest of my life? How does this relate to improving the quality of my life, or improving my effectiveness? And comes up with some really interesting answers. And
so would you, like, are you, after reading this book, now in a position where you can, you know, where that game, Memory Simon. I can't even remember what the damn game is.
Simon, where you have to remember the noises and the colors.
Yeah. So that just goes to show the poorest memory I have.
Going into this show, I was like, I have to talk about three books. I don't even know if I can remember the names of all the books and the authors.
So did you feel that this reading this book raised your game at all?
No. Because the one thing that becomes readily apparent is that learning these techniques, it's like learning the technique for long distance running or the shot put or anything else. You've got to put in the time, right? Like, the technique is step one. You have to put in the time, because he calls them memory palaces, right? And it's this technique of creating like a piece of architecture that you're very familiar with in your mind, and then creating all of these images. Because the one thing that he illustrates very early on is that human beings have a fantastic memory for images. And there's a very neat demonstration in it, which I won't ruin. But it's true. We remember images much better than we remember numbers or words or concepts. And so you use the memory palace to tie numbers and words and what have you to images. And then you place those images in this imaginary setting in your mind. But this whole process of building mental constructs and then populating them is incredibly labor-intensive, right? So,
well, that explains the book cover now.
Moonwalking with Einstein is one of his mental images. He sees himself moonwalking with Einstein, and that, and then the book cover shows the memory palace with all the crazy stuff going on, right? And then there's some fun stuff, because obviously the more lurid and outre an image is, the more it's likely to stick, right? So you come up with very moonwalking with Einstein, you come up with very oddball images. Also, sexual imagery tends to stick more than other kinds of imagery. So there's a very funny conversation at one point where he's talking to his coach Ed, and he's saying, like, you know, some of the, because they create combined images, right? So you'll have a single image that means one thing, and another image that means another thing, and another image that means another thing. And then this process sort of like randomly combines these images, in different ways. And then you create scenarios with those images, right? And you're supposed to, your core images are supposed to be common images that you're familiar with. So he's talking to his coach, and he's like, listen, like, I started with a lot of my family, and they're getting into some pretty weird situations.
And the coach is like, no.
No, and then the coach is like, I completely understand this happens all the time. I totally had to take my mother out. Like, I couldn't use her. I had to find something else. And so it's that kind of, there's, as serious as it is and as interesting as it is, there's a lightheartedness through it. I really, really found the whole thing appealing. I'm fascinated with the Four family now, right? Because the older brother is an editor for New Republic. Saffron Foer is this huge novelist. Josh Foer, he's married to Nicole Krauss. Josh Foer is, he's this huge talent. He got a $1.2 million advance for this book. Like, so they're like, to me, they're like the Glass family, right? They're like Salinger's Glass family. I'm like, these, I have to know more about them. Like, what's in the water?
As a callback to what you were saying about him being a responsible journalist in this forum, I was wondering, because it really kind of bugs me. So the International Festival of Authors is in Toronto right now. One of the authors that is here is Brooke Gladstone from NPR, which is on the media. She wrote a book called Influencing the Influencing Media, I guess, or the Influencing Machine, and she talks about how she talks in that book about how the prevailing science and understanding of the time, like, totally informs how we see media stuff, right? And so the brain is like a big deal right now, and right, so like, is Google making you stupid, and all of these like pseudoscience claims around brain science, when in fact we really know lick all about the brain, right? And so a pet peeve of mine, not of Brooke Gladstone's, but a pet peeve of mine is when an author or writer is really talking about the mind, but they're writing about the brain, right? So that those things that go along with thinking and go along with problem solving and processing stuff really don't translate to, like, there is no correlation in neuroscience, but we'd like there to be, right? So we make that leap in literature a lot. And I was wondering if he is careful to keep the kind of the mysteries of the mind and the mysteries of the brain separate.
My impression from reading the book, I got a really strong sense that he wasn't trying to have information that he didn't have. He wasn't trying to draw conclusions that were specious or just, you know, that required a leap. It's one of the problems that I have with nonfiction is that real life often doesn't, you know, fit itself into a really nice, tidy narrative. And then a lot of times in nonfiction books, you'll see the author struggling with that, right? They have this desire to ramp it up or to shape it and massage it and make it, you know, like a traditional three-act structure. He somehow manages to dance through the raindrops on this and accept the fact that there's so much that we don't know, and then so much of what we do know isn't always useful in the way that we want it to be useful, and yet it still ends up being a very satisfying narrative. I think that you might be surprised at where this book ends up. Pleasantly so.
Well, in the old days when we used to keep score about whether or not you, one of us was winning the other over to read the book, I'm like more enthusiastic now hearing you talk about it. Which is not a surprise, obviously, because it's like, oh, no, you like it? No, you like it? And we'll go back and forth. Whether or not I'll get to it, of course, as I say, you know, sometime after I get to Born to Run, I suppose. Okay, so that's it for the Enthusiastic Cast. Send us emails. We love getting emails. We read all the emails, and even if we don't respond right away, we really, really appreciate it. We can be reached at hello@enthusiasticcast.com. Tell us what books you are revved about, you are revved to read, and if we talk about the book that you recommend us, you can win a book of your choice. So until next time, I'm Mark.
And I'm John.
Thanks so much for listening.
Cheers.